You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Open Society Institute. For those of you who have not been here before, although I do see a lot of familiar faces in the audience, I'm Ann Beeson. I'm the Director of U.S. Programs here at the Open Society Institute, and I'm very thrilled to welcome all of you to a lively debate about David Cole and Jules LaBelle's latest book. I guess I hold it up right now, Less Safe, Less Free. And we have Jane Mayer here to moderate, I'm sure, an exciting conversation between Noah Feldman and David Cole about the book. As some of you know, the issues that David and Jules discuss in the book are very near and dear to my heart because before joining OSI in June, I was the Associate Legal Director at the American Civil Liberties Union, where I directed our national security program, and so was very directly involved in many, in some of the cases that are discussed in the book and in many of the advocacy efforts. And I've been thrilled to be able to support a number of other organizations through my new role here at OSI who have been working very tirelessly to kind of stem the backlash against civil rights and civil liberties and human rights in the name of national security since 9/11. I wanted to just kick us off by making a few remarks, and hopefully some of these themes will get picked up in the conversation between Noah and David. I don't think we even need to say any more at an event like this. State the obvious, which is that the U.S. government's counterterrorism policies have legitimized torture and arbitrary detention, they've authorized illegal spying, and they've defended racial profiling and excessive secrecy. I think it's also, at least in my view, a bit of a given that the consequences of these policies go far beyond our borders. They've destroyed U.S. credibility as a champion of human rights, and they've eroded support for human rights around the world, even outside the counterterrorism context. I really don't think it's an exaggeration to suggest that U.S. national security policies are threatening to unravel, in fact, the entire system of global human rights protections that have been developed since World War II. And for this reason, we all need to continue to pay very close attention to what's happening and to step up our involvement to restore human rights. Unfortunately, despite a lot of creative and strategic and inspiring work from a whole range of human rights and civil liberties champions here in the United States and around the world, many of them I'm happy to report with the support of the Open Society Institute, there's somewhat of a consensus that progress has been mostly incremental in the last 6 years. Congress largely abdicated its role as a check on executive power, and many courts sided with the administration, deferring to the perceived national security expertise of the executive branch. Of course, there were some very significant wins, and we should continue to celebrate those. They include the Department of Defense decision to return to its pre-9/11 commitment to the prohibition against torture, and they include the forced release through litigation and public pressure of hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that demonstrate U.S. torture policy was set at the very highest levels. They include the Supreme Court decisions in the Guantanamo cases, and they include a very impressive grassroots mobilization against the Patriot Act and expanded surveillance powers. But unfortunately, for every two steps forward, there has very often been one step back. And just to give a couple of quick examples, when advocates tried to limit the expansion of wiretapping powers under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, President Bush secretly authorized wiretapping without a warrant in direct violation of FISA. This is, of course, the NSA wiretapping program that continues to be challenged in litigation and which has unfortunately now been largely rubber-stamped by Congress. When the Supreme Court ruled that Guantanamo detainees had a limited right of review in federal courts, Congress promptly passed a law suspending habeas corpus rights. Though advocates succeeded in passing the McCain Amendment to oppose torture, by all accounts a huge milestone in the fight against torture, the law has no criminal enforcement mechanism, and the administration continues to defend harsh interrogation techniques. So the next 5 years, I think, will determine whether human rights protections are restored or whether their loss becomes permanent. A new administration in 2009, whatever it is, will present a range of opportunities and challenges for restoring human rights and civil liberties. And I want to just mention two strategies that I think can help ensure a return to normalcy. To prepare for the next phase of our support for this work here at OSI, we recently completed a pretty broad field assessment in which we interviewed over 50 advocates and experts in the national security field. And many of the ideas that emerged for the next phase of work from that assessment are very much in sync with the analysis in David and Jewel's book, I'm happy to report. First, we think that the next phase of advocacy must more aggressively challenge the paradigms relied upon by the Bush administration to justify its counterterrorism policies, to avoid accountability for its abuses, and to defy the rule of law. And, of course, there are three different paradigms. They're all very closely related. Several of them are touched upon or discussed at length in the book. Those include the war on terror paradigm, the dominant paradigm, I would say, the ever-expanding executive power paradigm, and finally the prevention paradigm, which, of course, is discussed at length in the book. We must, in the next phase of advocacy, dismantle these paradigms and shift the public debate to protect human rights. The question is, how do we do that? What emerged from many interviews that we conducted is the dire need, frankly, to develop and widely disseminate a strong alternative national security policy that respects human rights and the rule of law and proposes concrete solutions. We need stronger communications and public education efforts to convince Americans that human rights and the rule of law actually make us safer, another point again made in the book. We also need credible, objective national security experts that can develop, refine, and communicate, again, an affirmative, progressive national security policy that doesn't sacrifice human rights. Secondly, I think we need to begin to connect the erosion of human rights and civil liberties in the name of national security to the broader history and experience of human rights abuses in America. Nearly every human rights abuse justified as a counterterrorism policy was first tried out here at home in other contexts. Just as the war on drugs continues to target poor, primarily people of color, for profiling, arbitrary detention, and abuse, the war on terror continues to target Arabs, South Asians, and Muslims with nearly identical human rights abuses. We need to do a better job of connecting advocates and communities to build a broader constituency for addressing both sets of rights violations. I want to stop there and just quickly give a few necessary rules for this forum. One is just not rules, but just practices. One is just, I really do encourage, as you can see, we have a kind of a not-so-great sound system here. I would encourage everybody, the speakers and audience members, when you're asking questions, to speak directly into the microphone. We are also recording the event, and it probably will be made available later on OSI's website. I'm also supposed to point out the closest emergency exit, which is right over here, but we are not anticipating any emergency. And
never are.
I know, exactly. I think that's it. I now want to just very briefly introduce Jane Mayer, who has graciously agreed to moderate the conversation tonight. Jane Mayer, who I'm sure many of you know from her terrific articles in The New Yorker, joined The New Yorkers as a staff writer in March of 1995. She's based in D.C. and writes about politics for the magazine and has been, of course, covering for the last few years the war on terror. She's written a range of articles on everything from the Pentagon's secret torture policy to the CIA's illegal rendition program to conditions at Guantanamo and the legality of CIA interrogations. She's also written about George W. Bush, the Bin Laden family, Karl Rove, and the television show 24. And I know, of course, I'm sure that there are various people who are probably closet watchers of that television show. I am not one of them. I am a boycotter of the show for what I hope are obvious reasons. But anyway, with that, I turn it over to you, Jane, and Jane's going to introduce David and Noah a little more thoroughly. Thanks again, and welcome to OSI.
Thanks, Ann. Much appreciate that. For people who are actually secret fans of 24, you have to check out the new trailer for the new season, which is just unbelievable. It's the best advertisement that Hollywood could make for torture. So it's not to be missed. Anyway, I'm really glad to be here today with two of the foremost public intellectuals in the area of law and the post-9/11 world. I was taught when you are in this ring with two world-class pugilists, the only thing to do is duck, so I'm going to try to just get them to swat at each other as much as I can. We're here today to discuss David Cole, and Jules LaBelle's book. I'm going to call it David's book from here at this point on. Less Safe, Less Free, Why America's Losing the War on Terror. And as many of you probably know, David Cole is a professor at Georgetown University's Law Center, a volunteer staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, the legal affairs correspondent for The Nation, and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and a commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. He's the author of two award-winning books, Enemy Aliens, which received the American Book Award in 2004, and No Equal Justice, Race and Class in the American Criminal Justice System, which was named Best Nonfiction Book in 1999 by the Boston Book Review, and the best book on an issue of national policy in 1999 by the American Political Science Association. Anthony Lewis has described David as one of the country's great legal voices for civil liberties today. Okay, Noah Feldman specializes in constitutional studies with a particular emphasis on the relationship between law and religion, constitutional design, and the history of legal theory. He's professor of law at Harvard Law School. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And before joining the Harvard faculty, Feldman was the Cecilia, I don't know how to pronounce this, Goetz Professor of Law at NYU Law School. And in 2003, he served as a senior constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, and subsequently advised members of the Iraqi Governing Council on drafting the constitution, the interim constitution. We might want to know what happened at the end of that situation. As you can see, these guys are total slackers. So I'm going to ask the obvious question of David, which is the book is that is entitled Less Safe, Less Free. Are we less safe? In some ways, you might take a look at the record and say it's a perfect record of safety. We haven't been attacked by a terrorist since 9/11, and I think it's an argument we're going to be seeing a lot of during this coming campaign. So, in what way less safe?
Well, that's a great opening question, and let me start by saying that I'm delighted to be here, and I'm very grateful to OSI for all the support it has given me on basically all of my books, including this latest one. I couldn't have done it without OSI's support, so I'm especially grateful for that, and I'm also grateful to have people as thoughtful as Jane and Noah here up here with me. So, how are we less safe? It is true that the strongest argument that the government, the Bush administration, makes and makes anytime it can is that there hasn't been another terrorist attack in the United States since September 11th, and we wrote this book in large part to answer that very argument. And the most important part of the book, I think, is indeed the second section, which is the demonstration that we are, in fact, less safe. Whenever the government makes this argument, it always, to me, calls to mind Tom Ridge's resignation speech when he stepped down as the first head of Homeland Security. He said there have been no terrorist attacks since 9/11 under my watch. And then he knocked on the podium. And that night, John Stewart played that clip on The Daily Show, and he said, "Did I just see the leader of Homeland Security for the most powerful nation in the world knocking on wood?" And indeed he did, and we argue that that Tom Ridge may as well have been knocking on wood for all the good that the preventive paradigm measures in particular, and that's what this book is critical of, this preventive paradigm. We'll talk about that more as we go forward. All the good they've done in terms of netting actual terrorists, disrupting actual plots. So, you know, you begin, I'll just give a couple of highlights. I can't give the whole sense of it. But in the first 2 years after 9/11, they rounded up over 5,000 foreign nationals and locked them up in preventive detention measures on the grounds that they might be terrorists. How many of them today stand convicted of a terrorist offense? Zero. They then spread the net a little bit wider, and they said, let's go out and interview all the young Arab Muslim immigrants who've recently come to the country, 8,000 of them. Maybe we'll find a terrorist. We don't know much about al-Qaeda, but we knew, though, they're young Arab Muslim foreign nationals. 8,000. they sought out for interview. How many of them stand convicted of a terrorist offense today? Zero. They then spread the net even wider, and they said, well, let's call in all the Arab Muslim men and require them to come in for special registration, fingerprinting, photographing, interviewing at INS. Again, we might find a terrorist. 83,000 came in on pain of deportation if they didn't. How many of them stand convicted of a terrorist offense? Zero. If you combine those figures, and that I think is evidence of the widest campaign of ethnic profiling this country has seen since the Japanese internment, and the government's record is zero for 96,000. That doesn't make us safer. That statistic is not found on the government's websites for how they're doing in the war on terror. They left that one out for some reason. But instead, they have other statistics. So they indicted over 400 people in terror-related cases. They convicted over 200 people in terror-related cases. Well, that sounds like a lot of terrorists. 400 cases in just 5 or 6 years? Until you actually look at the cases. And when you look at the cases, as we did, it turns out that the vast majority of them, 90-some percent of them, actually have no terrorist charge in them whatsoever. They're for minor offenses like credit card fraud or check writing fraud or filling out a federal form falsely or immigration violations or not doing your reading on time in law school, those kinds of things, not for terrorist crimes or even violent crimes. Then there are a handful that are for terrorist crimes. The Washington Post looked at all the convictions and found that only 39 of the convictions actually had a terrorist charge. We look at those 39, and it turns out that virtually all of those are under this extremely broad statute called the Material Support for Terrorist Organization Statute that allows the government to get a conviction without proving that an individual engaged in any terrorism, planned any terrorism, supported any terrorism. All they have to show is that the individual did something of benefit to benefit some group that has been put on a blacklist through a secretive process that's essentially gives the government a blank check to put any prescribed organization on that list. And so those cases don't even prove that they've netted actual terrorists. In terms of Islamic terrorists brought to justice for an attempted terrorist act since 9/11, there's been one, Richard Reid, the shoe bomber. And he wasn't captured through any innovative preventive paradigm measure of John Ashcroft in the Justice Department, but because this alert airline attendant saw this strange-looking guy trying to light his shoe. And 6 years now, we've had 6 years of incredible focus on the Arab and Muslim community in the United States, and we have yet to find a single Al-Qaeda cell. So you get a lot of zeros, but of course it's not just zeros. It's also the fact that our preventive measures, including in particular the preventive war in Iraq, have made us less safe. We did some good originally in closing down the Al-Qaeda cells and the Al-Qaeda training camps headquarters in Afghanistan, a traditional self-defense response to an attack. But then we shifted to this preventive war in Iraq, and by doing so, we have created the best possible training ground for terrorists. We have inspired more terrorists to join the charge. Whole new terrorist groups that didn't even exist before 9/11 have sprung up and have taken their focus on us. Al-Qaeda has fully reconstituted itself, according to our security agencies, while we've been focused on Iraq. And, of course, we've also lost close to 4,000 American and 75 to 85,000 Iraqi lives in doing so. So all of this contributes to this incredible, steeply rising trend of anti-Americanism that, to our minds, is the greatest threat to national security as we go forward.
Okay. Well, now, Noah, this is the Soros Foundation believes in debate, so let's hear the other side.
Good. So first of all, thank you very much for having me. I'm also honored to be here with David and Jane, two people whose work I admire enormously. And since I take it from the introduction that and from the support that OSI has offered to David's book and the fact that people are here to hear about David's book, that many people will agree with much or all of what David has just had to say, and I would add the body language in the room to that, I will take it upon myself to disagree with him, not because I disagree with him in every particular, but because I think it's important to present some plausible arguments on the other side. So if I find myself here sometimes, I will try to stop myself from making any argument I don't believe in, but I am going to have to adopt a subject position which might not be the one I would naturally adopt. So with that apologetic introduction, here goes. Now, there are two wrong criteria on the table right now. The first wrong criterion is the Bush administration's wrong criterion, which is that if you have not been attacked, the United States has not been attacked, it follows that we are safer. That is what is called fallacious reasoning. We could be in equal jeopardy of being attacked. Attacks could be being planned. We could have raised substantially, and we perhaps have raised substantially, the threat risk to ourselves and not have been attacked. So that's an example of fallacious reasoning. But David's analysis, which focused just now on how many convictions of terrorists there have been for terrorist acts, is equally fallacious. It's fallacious because the position that the administration took, and not just the administration, but even the reasonable civil servant people who care about keeping the country safe, took after 9/11, was not that we were going to try to convict a lot of terrorists. In fact, to the contrary, the express policy, and this was a direct order given to the Justice Department, was that we should not be focusing on convictions, we should be focusing on prevention. Now, what follows from that? Well, the first thing that follows from it is that you can't convict someone of a terrorist act until they have performed a terrorist act. And we do not want anybody to perform a terrorist act. So what we want to do is use all the tools available, all the legal tools available, to try to intervene before such events occur. Now, if you accept, which you may not, that I am right, that it's just as wrong to say that the number of convictions is a measure of how safe we are as it is to say that the absence of terrorist attacks are a measure of how safe we are, then a very fair question to put to me would be, then how do we know? How could we possibly know? Right? And here I think we're going to have to accept some pieces of painful reality, namely that we're going to have to make some projections about things about which we can't have perfect facts. So, number one, Al-Qaeda has a substantial disincentive to attempt an attack on the United States that is smaller in scale and effect than 9/11. Okay? Why is that? Because at no point has the objective of Al-Qaeda internationally been to bring down the government of the United States of America. Had that been their objective after 9/11, there are many, many very small-scale, low-cost things to them they could have done which would have wreaked havoc on our country. They could have engaged in very small-scale attacks which didn't even have to kill anybody in random places across the country. And they could have created significant terror across the country. If, as Larry Wright, I don't know if any of you saw his one-man show, which was a version of his book, as he seemed to believe in his one-man show, the goal of Al-Qaeda was somehow to cause the United States to enter into a scenario of shutting down civil liberties in a way that, remarkably enough, is correspondent to a movie that Larry Wright wrote a few years ago. Had that been their goal, there are any number of things that they could have done at a relatively small scale that would have had this effect. So that's the first point. They are focused on not on bringing us to our knees, but focused rather on reaching an international and primarily Muslim audience and convincing them of a particular view of the world and a particular stance towards the world. To do that, a spectacular attack like 9/11 was appropriate, and it was appropriate from their standpoint. Obviously, it was wrong and terrible and evil, but it was, from their perspective, appropriate insofar as it pushed the United States, and bin Laden said this just the most recent time he appeared to give us a tape, it pushed the United States to take action in the Middle East that actually put us in precisely the position that he wanted us to be in, namely the position of being occupiers of a Muslim country. Now, before 9/11, he said we were occupiers of a Muslim country, and that was a lie. Now, we are occupiers of two Muslim countries, so the position is a little less implausible. But from his perspective, this is relatively clear, he accomplished his objectives, and there's no need for a follow-on attack, at least not at this juncture. Okay, that's point one. Point two. With respect to the likelihood or the possibility of smaller scale, not directly Al-Qaeda coordinated attacks happening through the United States, it seems to me preposterous to argue that the vastly increased surveillance that has been undertaken by federal and state and even in this city, municipal agencies, has had zero effect on deterring people from engaging in various low-level terrorist attacks. Why? Because a significant pattern that can be discerned in terrorist attacks that have taken place all over the world is that targets that are easily available for attack tend to be the ones that are attacked. It's mostly about the low-hanging fruit. This makes terrorists exactly like all other human beings. When I want to achieve an objective, I don't usually pick the hardest possible goal to achieve that objective. I pick the easiest possible way to achieve that objective. And in this respect, terrorists are not like marathon runners. They're like the rest of us. They're not people who set an impossible task for themselves just to prove that they can do it. So removing easy vectors of attack is significant, and creating a perception that is harder to attack us is also significant. Can this be proven definitively? No, it cannot. Certainly not without disclosing the content of these surveillance techniques. And many of the results of those, in fact, I would be willing to stipulate that all of them, if disclosed publicly, would be totally unconvincing to everybody in this room, right? Because in each and every case, it would be possible to say that this thus and such a person speaking on tape, being surveilled, was just making a religious point, which would be First Amendment protected, or just expressing a justifiable frustration with American foreign policy, which anyone in the room might have expressed. And in each and every one of those cases, I'm pretty convinced you would be very hard-pressed to find something that sounds, quote-unquote, like it is about to produce terrorism. But again, from that it does not follow that raising the degree of difficulty of terrorist attacks has had no effect. Last point, if I have just a moment to make another point, because I don't want to drone on. But on this question of the preventive paradigm, which David has written so interestingly about, it's true that the administration framed the war in Iraq as a piece of the war on terror. That was obviously never true in the literal sense that there were no ties that anyone could prove between al-Qaeda and Iraq. So that was always not the case. On the other hand, there was a broader justification for the invasion of Iraq connected to the war on terror, one that has gone badly awry. And the argument went like this. The argument was that the big picture cause of terror is that the United States has bad policies of supporting autocrats, and that people in Muslim countries don't like the autocrats who the United States supports, and this causes them not to like us. This view was derived from reading the works of bin Laden, in part, and looking at polling data, in part. And the Bush administration, whatever its failings, and they are legion, expressly rejected our 50 years of foreign policy in the Middle East as immoral and as mistaken. It did. That is over now. The administration is backing away from that view like crazy, and the Democratic Party, of which I am a card-carrying member, is now being dominated in foreign policy elite circles by foreign policy realists who believe that the correct policy of the United States towards the Muslim world is to support the dictators and the autocrats and to do nothing about human rights. Let us be very clear about this. Let us be extremely clear about this. Right now, there is no constituency among Republican or Democratic foreign policy elites for improving our policies towards dictators in the Muslim world. The Bush administration is still talking about it, but is obviously not doing it, and no Democrat is even talking about it. Okay, listen to read the debates. Where the sort of debates are a bad place to look for foreign policy, but look at that. Look at the one-on-one interviews. Look at, you know, the one-on-one interviews with the candidates on foreign policy questions. And I think you will see that this is the case. So, if it is true that terrorism bears some relationship to the suppression of political and civil liberties in countries around the world which we support, and I believe it to be true, I don't think it's a unicausal explanation, but I think it's a major cause, then we are at present in the utter absence of any plausible account from any domestic political constituency or from any presidential candidate in any party that might be seen as taking some steps towards improving that situation. And that is a sad, sad state of affairs.
David, I could raise a few questions about this. I suppose if the real aim of al-Qaeda has been achieved, and with the spectacular attack of 9/11, and they're no longer interested in attacking the United States, I wonder then, why are we still operating as if we are in a state of emergency that requires putting so much emphasis on fighting terrorism and describing it as a war and detaining people seemingly in an unlimited way? But that's one question I've got. David, I imagine you've got quite a few questions about this.
The first thing I'd say, if you read Jack Goldsmith's book, The Terror Presidency, he describes quite effectively, I think, the sort of internal psychology of the administration as responding to the daily threat assessments that they get exposed to, and basically argues that anybody who is exposed to the kind of information that on a daily basis they are provided about threat assessments would feel tremendous obligation to do what we can to prevent the next attack, and that those threat assessments do not suggest that al-Qaeda has sort of given up and figured it's won and declared victory, but is actually still doing what it can to, everything it can to continue to attack us and provoke us and inspire others to its cause. So, you know, and then that's backed up by the fact that the National Intelligence Estimate tells us that al-Qaeda has indeed fully reconstituted itself. So, you know, we did some damage, I think, initially in the in Afghanistan, but we have lost all of that. So I don't think one can sort of sit back and say that there is no threat. I think one needs to think about how you effectively and responsibly respond to the threat. Let me say two responses to Noah's points. First on whether convictions is a relevant fact to consider. Well, obviously the Bush administration thinks it's a relevant fact to consider, because if you look at their website on how they are winning the war on terror, that's number one on their claim, 400 plus indictments and 200 plus convictions, with the attempt to try to tell us that they've got a lot of terrorists. Same thing with the detentions. Every time John Ashcroft got on television in the first, you know, months after 9/11, he announced how many terror suspects they had detained. Again, sort of saying, look, we're doing something. When it turned out none of them were terrorists, they didn't hold a press conference to announce that. But secondly, it seems to me that while it is true that if you are successful in deterring people from even trying to engage in terrorist activity, you're not going to find a conviction. If you are successful in preventing a terrorist plot or a terrorist conspiracy, you ought to not only be able to claim that we've disrupted a terrorist plot, but you ought to be able to bring people to justice for that. So, for example, pre-9/11, we disrupted a terrorist plot here in New York to blow up the bridges and tunnels around Manhattan. But we didn't just claim that we had disrupted a terrorist plot. We brought the perpetrators to justice, and they, Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman and his co-conspirators, are now spending the rest of their lives in federal prison where they pose no threat to us. So with conspiracy laws and attempt laws on the books, if you have a real terrorist plot that you disrupt, you ought to be able to bring people to justice. In England, they've disrupted some real terrorist plots, and they have indeed brought them to justice. But when you look at the terrorist plots that have been brought to justice here in the United States, you know, they look very different. So this case that just went on trial down in Florida involving a kind of odd multi sort of multicultural religious sect. That's, I think, part Muslim, part Christian, part Jewish, part Hindu, in which a federal informant infiltrated the sect and ultimately convinced them that he was an al-Qaeda member and got them to pledge allegiance to al-Qaeda and to plan a terrorist attack. Well, what was the terrorist attack they planned? To blow up the Sears Tower. They'd never been to Chicago, and the only overt act they took in furtherance of it was to ask this federal FBI agent to order for them supplies for the attack, which were combat boots and horses. So, you know, you got to, and then, you know, and then there's the guy who, another one that the government puts up as, you know, one of their successes in the terror prevention, was the guy who was allegedly researching whether he could bring down the Brooklyn Bridge with an acetylene torch. He concluded that was not likely to be a successful terrorist attack, but we convicted him anyway.
But David, I can, to play devil's advocate, say that there are 14 so-called high-value detainees now in Guantanamo who were in the CIA's custody before, that include KSM, who was considered the mastermind of the 9/11 plot, and there are quite a few others there that are considered serious terrorists.
Yes.
And at the same time, you could also argue that bin Laden, while he's not in U.S. custody, hasn't been captured, he and Ayman Zawahiri are so on the run that they've been unable to plot, and we haven't really seen their hand in any of these attacks that have happened subsequently in Europe and in Africa. So, I mean, it's what do you argue back, and casting it forward, what will somebody from your point of view argue in the coming election when it's clear this is going to be a huge issue? You take a look at the new ad that was just made by Tom Tancredo. It is the most pure and unadulterated fear campaign that I've seen. It goes way beyond, we've had the bear and the wolf in earlier presidential elections. This one is just pure terror. It's basically vote for the Republicans, because if you vote for the Democrats, you'll die. They have something that they can boast about. Many of the people who were the really important players in the 9/11 plot are either in captivity or put out of business. How would somebody who wants to take on this new paradigm argue against that in a political context?
Right. Well, let me. I'm not a politician, so but I'll venture a response. But let me first talk about the 14 high value detainees. We don't contend that they have not captured anybody who poses a threat or who was involved in terrorism. But even with respect to the 14 high-level detainees, it seems to us that the preventive paradigm has backfired. So the preventive paradigm with respect to the 14 high-value detainees said that in the name of preventing the next terrorist attack, it is justified to use to disappear them into CIA black sites and then to use coercive interrogation tactics, or enhanced interrogation techniques, as President Bush calls them, torture as the rest of the world calls it, to try to get information from them. And so what do we know about that? Well, we know that some information we obtained was false, some information we obtained was true. We don't know whether we would have obtained the same information without employing these tactics. But what we do know for certain is that because of these tactics, we have sort of we have painted ourselves in a corner, and we can't bring them to justice. This came up right on September 12th. There's a meeting in the White House, and Bob Mueller and John Ashcroft and the NSC are all there, and Mueller is saying, we've got to find the people who supported the 9/11 attacks, and we've got to bring them in, and we've got to do it in a way that we can bring them to justice and lock them up for the rest of their lives, and meaning we've got to do it in a way that's lawful. And John Ashcroft interrupts him and says, wait a minute, Bob, wait, I got to stop you right there. Our job is to prevent the next attack. If we can't try them, so be it. In other words, don't bother with the legal niceties of how you capture people, how you interrogate people, how you gather evidence, because, if we can't try them, so be it. And we're now in this position where we haven't had a single person tried at Guantanamo in 6 years. And think how different Guantanamo would look to the world if we had tried some of the people who are actually culpable actors, and there certainly are some there, and tried them in a fair trial and convicted them and sentenced them to life in prison. I think it would change the whole dynamic of Guantanamo. Similarly, for those we don't try, if we had simply abided by the basic principles of the laws of war, if we'd given them hearings, if we treated them humanely, the Guantanamo would not be the international embarrassment that it is today. The world doesn't question the notion that a country can hold those who are fighting against it for the duration of the conflict. The world doesn't question that we had the right to respond to Al-Qaeda by taking military action in Afghanistan. The UN said it was an act of self-defense. NATO said it was an act of self-defense. 120 nations signed on. So the notion that we're holding people who are fighting against us is not controversial. What's controversial is this decision in the name of prevention to refuse to provide any sort of process to interrogate them in inhumane and coercive ways, so that we are now left with this untenable situation where even President Bush thinks we have to close Guantanamo because we can't try them, and the world we have lost all credibility in terms of our justifications for holding them without trial. So I think the response, to the fear campaign. I mean, I think it's always hard to respond to the fear campaign. But again, the principal reason we wrote this book was to say, let's look at what they've done. Acting tough and talking tough, as the Bush crowd likes to do, may play well politically, but you have to ask, what is it doing for us? Is it in fact making America a safer place, or is it making America a more vulnerable place? And I think a very strong argument can be made that it has done very little to make us safer, and it has done quite a bit to make us more vulnerable. It has tied our hands in terms of bringing people to justice. It has spurred a tremendous rise in anti-Americanism. It has given al-Qaeda exactly what it wanted in terms of recruitment propaganda. If you ask it from the standpoint of Donald Rumsfeld, are we creating more terrorists every day than we're capturing or killing? I think the answer is quite clearly we are creating more because of these preventive mechanisms. And then I think you also have to have an alternative, which we put forward in part three of the book.
I was just going to follow up with Noah about whether or not you, as a supporter of the war in Iraq, felt in retrospect that it had made us safer. And if not, in some ways, I think David would argue and argues in the book that it followed logically from the fact that it was a preventive war, that it was a war that was going to backfire in many ways. And I wonder... first of all, any regrets? And
well, the first thing I would say is, I mean, before the war, I was an unknown assistant professor who could not get an op-ed published on any topic, and actually never did support the war, not publicly and not privately. And in the one thing that I did publish before then, which was a book, I basically said there are many, many reasons to think this is going to be a disaster, because all of the arguments that the first Bush administration followed when they chose not to invade Baghdad a decade ago all still apply today, and it's utterly unclear what could be done subsequently. And what's more, it's relatively clear that there are no that the administration doesn't believe there are any weapons of mass destruction. So I don't count myself as a supporter of the war, nor do I count myself as having been an opponent. I was also not out there, on the barricades saying this is a terrible mistake. And when I was asked to go to Iraq, after clarifying that I didn't think they were going to let me go because I was a Democrat, it took me 30 seconds to agree to go, because I believed then, and I still believe now, that success in Iraq, at the time I imagined success was still possible, now it's just a less bad failure, should be a truly nonpartisan issue, because it is deeply against the national interest of the United States. It was against the national interest of the United States to fail as we did, and it continues to be against the interest of the United States to continue to fail. As we failed. I do, however, have enormous regrets about the things that have happened since then, including things that I was involved in. I mean, when I did go to Iraq and was working on the constitutional process there, the system was set up in such a way that, well, there was no system. I think that's probably the most honest way of putting it. There was no chain of command. There was no way to get opinions clarified up the chain. About the best you could do was get in to see Bremer or get in to see Wolfowitz and tell them why they were full of it, and then have them essentially ignore you. I did that on a couple of occasions, and then after that I couldn't get any more meetings with them, not so surprisingly. And I think there's plenty of regret to go around, and I'm happy to share in it, and blame to go around, and I'm happy to share in that, for the way that the political process was relied upon as though it were a solution to the problems that Iraq was facing. Those of us who were involved in the political process rather than on the security side were constantly telling people on the security side, you're going to cover us on the security side, right? If you do that, we're going to deliver you a political process where the major constituencies are going to sit down and agree with each other. And once they've agreed with each other, we're going to be able to broker a peace. And we delivered that a couple of times. And each time they got together and they all agreed on something. First they agreed on the interim constitution, then they agreed on the final constitution, then they had elections and they agreed on a government. And they, it's basically the same set of Iraqi politicians in each and every one of these cases. They were unelected to begin with, but then when there were elections, the same people got elected. And each and every time, the agreement they reached was totally valueless, empty of value. And it was empty of value because it didn't correspond to a security reality on the ground. We had failed to secure the country in the most basic and fundamental way. And it took me and others involved on the political side a long time to realize this. I would say it was the summer of 2004 before it became brutally obvious, by which time I was out of the government, before it became brutally obvious that this whole political process, which we were so invested in, was a sham. And was a sham not just because we were occupiers, we knew that all along, so we knew there were some sham-like features, but it was a sham because the constituency that was supposed to listen to its political leadership wasn't listening to their political leadership, because they didn't see their political leaders delivering them anything useful. They weren't delivering them any form of government. Let me just say one word about why I think this particular mistake was made by, I'm not talking about all the other mistakes, but by the subgroup that I was involved with. It was because there were too many lawyers there, and I include myself in this. And as lawyers, we were big believers in things called constitutions and in things called bills of rights and in the idea that legal institutions, of which elections are a part, so legal and political institutions, but especially legal institutions, were the route to accomplishing basic security on the ground and a functioning state. That was wrong, dead wrong. And I frankly hear a different version of this when David is talking about how, you know, the real problem with Guantanamo is that we haven't put people on trial. Now, I mean, Guantanamo is a disaster from start to finish. It should never have been conceived the way it was. Of course, it should, you know, it's problematic in every imaginable respect. But the really bad things about Guantanamo, and they are many, I do not think inhere in the fact that we can't put Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on trial. I don't think anybody cares about that, frankly, in the general world. And I think that if the Democrats rely on an argument like that when they have to run for president, they're going to get their heads handed to them on national security, as they traditionally have done. Now, the reason we were wrong in the constitutional context is that you cannot afford, the rule of law is essentially a practice that emerges after there is a powerful state capable of forcing people not to shoot each other. The law part comes first. Sorry, the law part comes second. The order part comes first. And the law part comes second. You see, I'm such a lawyer that I can't even get it out of my head. I still think that the law part comes first. No, the law part does not come first. The order part comes first. And once you have order, then you can talk about a legal set of legal institutions that are capable of producing legitimacy for that order. But if you don't have the order in the first place, it doesn't matter whether you have a bunch of lawyers running around saying, it's legitimate, look at our great Bill of Rights. You know, that's a really an embarrassing thing it turns out to be saying and doing. And it is guaranteed to lead to the kind of civil war that we've got in Iraq right now. So that's my, you know, own, that's where I feel most, compromised, by virtue of having been deeply invested in this legal constitutional picture, and saying, well, that's not my, when it came to the security on the ground, saying, well, that's not my department, that's why we have a U.S. Army.
Okay. I think at this point I may open things up to the floor and see what kind of questions we've got here, if anybody's got them. There seems to be one there.
It seems to be two different issues when you're talking about, it's true that you need order on the ground in order to have law. But at Guantanamo there is order. This is a U.S. jail. And it does do harm not to get people at Guantanamo on trial in our international reputation and our credibility as a country.
Well, you're right. Those are two different points. And I'm sorry if it sounded as though I were conflating them. I was making two separate points. The first point was that with respect to Iraq, a characteristic lawyer's mistake, of which I, among other lawyers, was guilty, was thinking that law would somehow get us someplace without order. And there's a separate lawyer's mistake, I think, which is not that we shouldn't put people on trial rather than holding them indefinitely. I'm all for that. It's that what's the claim that what's really wrong in Guantanamo, or that one of the important things that's wrong in Guantanamo is that we can't put people on trial. What's wrong in Guantanamo is you have an enormous number of people detained for no good reason. You have no effective process for letting loose the people who are in fact there. But the overwhelming majority of those people, I don't think anyone denies this, from the unimportant people who aren't guilty of anything to the very important people who are guilty of something that we only know about through using coercive techniques to find out. Almost none of those people are convictable of anything. They're not convictable of anything. The people who are innocent because they're not guilty of anything, and the people who are really guilty of some very bad things because they've been subjected to coercive techniques that basically render them not triable. Now, with respect to that small group of high-value people, there's a question that David is raising, an important question, of what should have been done when they were caught. We should make it as specific as possible. What should have been done with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind, when they caught him? Right? I mean, whatever the answer to that question is, and this is the only claim I'm making, it doesn't include the sentence, something that will enable us to put him on trial later. That's all I'm saying.
And I guess my response to that is it has to be something that can enable us to put him on trial later, if you are a country that believes in the rule of law. It's the rule of law that legitimizes the state's power. It's the rule of law that legitimizes our response to Al-Qaeda, and it's our departures from the rule of law that play precisely into al-Qaeda's hands. And again, I mean, I will go back to Guantanamo. I think I just don't see anybody around the world who has questioned the notion that the United States has the right to respond to the attacks that we suffered by going to Afghanistan. There are people who say it wasn't the best policy, but no one argued it was not a legitimate act of self-defense. Secondly, I've seen nobody who questions the notion that a country that is in a military conflict, a just military conflict, that one that's consistent with the laws of war as opposed to Iraq, has the right to hold those who are fighting against them. If you have the right to go to war, you have the right to kill the people you're fighting against, surely you have the right to hold them for the duration of that conflict. So that's not a controversial notion, and holding them at Guantanamo would not have been a controversial practice had we given them hearings at the outset, which, for one, would have identified those people as to whom we had no evidence that they were involved with al-Qaeda, and then they would be released, and then we wouldn't have the problem of innocent people being held at Guantanamo. Similarly, if we had decided to abide by our commitments and the world's commitments not to subject people who are detained to inhumane treatment, not to interrogate Mohammed al-Qahtani for something like 180 days straight with for 18 to 20 hours a day, and to inject him with IV fluids until he urinates on himself, and to require him to wear women's underwear, and to threaten him with attack dogs, and to strip him naked. Right? If we had not done that and we had treated these people humanely, I don't think the world would be objecting to that. So, and we would have been in a position where we could have put on trial somebody like Mohammed al-Qahtani, who is allegedly the 20th hijacker. And I think that would have changed. And I think this question here is exactly right. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the rule of law in Iraq, where, yes, you have to establish order. But we had order here in the United States. We had the rule of law on our side. And what we did was throw it overboard. And to me, the most telling statement in the entire post 9/11 period is a statement that appears in the 2005 National Security Strategy that says the strength of the nation state, meaning ours, will continue to be challenged by a strategy of the weak using international fora, judicial processes, and terrorism. That is a remarkable statement because it associates the rule of law with a strategy of the weak and with terrorism. And this comes directly from Jack Goldsmith in his book. He quotes it with pride and talks about how it was his memo to Don Rumsfeld about lawfare and about how international law and law generally is a restriction on the strength of the United States. But that's exactly where they went wrong. And our argument in the book is that we should not be listening to people like Jack Goldsmith, who treat law as something disposable, who say that the problem was not that there were too few, that the administration was lawless, but that it was strangled by law. We should be listening to people like Justice Aaron Barak of the Supreme Court of Israel, who says that a democracy must fight terrorism with one hand tied behind its back, but it succeeds against its enemies precisely for that reason, because the rule of law and the liberty of an individual are important components in its understanding of security. At the end of the day, they strengthen its spirit, and that spirit allows them to overcome. That's the right view of the rule of law, as an asset in fighting someone like al-Qaeda, not as an obstacle. And I think we took the latter view from day one when John Ashcroft said, forget about the rule of law, preventive, preventive, preventive.
Jane, I know you have an agenda. Can I make a quick response to everyone?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Sure.
A couple of just very, very small points. I think it's important to be clear, both in the case of Jack Goldsmith and Justice Barak, about what they're actually saying. I happen to agree with David. I think he's right that it's a fundamentally mistaken notion to think that law, whether domestic or international, is somehow a tool that can be used or that is primarily used by the weak or by enemies of the government. In fact, I think the opposite is true. I think law is designed by the powerful. This used to be the view of people on the left. I don't know. The people on the left don't sound the same way to me recently than they used to sound. But I have this old-fashioned leftist view that law is essentially a product of power structures, that the United States played a major role in the creation of most international law because we thought it was in our interests to do so, and that it remains in our interests to do so. So I think that there's a fundamental error in that analysis. That said, it is not the case that Jack then advocated the violation of law. To the contrary, Jack personally, and I think this is very clear from his book and from his actions, argued for, much more than many other people in the administration, for responsible interpretations of the law. And almost everybody in the administration, including the people whose legal analysis was the most outrageous, take John Yoo as the great example of this, they, let's be honest, they thought they were articulating a legal theory. Right? It was a bad legal theory, but in the end, the argument about whether something is a good legal theory or a bad legal theory is just something that lawyers argue about all the time. And there will be no, and so this is going to lead to a sort of somewhat more substantial point. The rule of law itself is, it turns out, not a guarantor against the kinds of abuses that David and I also think are terrible abuses. Now, that sounds like a preposterous thing to say, so what do I mean? What I mean is that within the framework of the rule of law, people with power will interpret the law to authorize a very wide range of things that they think are necessary under the circumstances. So the administration doesn't believe that it practiced torture. They redefined torture in such a way that what they were doing was not torture. The administration does not believe that they permitted illegal spying through FISA. They believe they had a legal interpretation that authorized it. And the point about this is not that you can't say they're wrong. Sure, you present it to a group of lawyers, and 99 lawyers out of 100 would say they're wrong. The point is there will be some lawyers who will say they're right. And lest we forget, law is tremendously flexible and malleable, and what people think law means at time one is not what people think it means at time two. And the punchline to this is Justice Barak, because in the very same opinion of the Israeli High Court that David just quoted, just a few lines later, Justice Barak discusses the question of what happens when the government seeks authority to torture in a ticking time bomb case. And Justice Barak says, they don't have the authority to torture in a ticking time bomb case. That's the rule of law. But, and this is the big but in his opinion, he says, but if the government did torture in a ticking time bomb case and criminal charges were brought against the people who tortured, they would have available to them the defense of necessity, the legal defense that says if something really bad is going to happen, and I had to choose between this bad thing that I had to do and something else really, really bad happening, it's okay for me to choose to do the thing that I did, the crime that I did, that otherwise would be a crime. Now, this is Justice Barak, whom David was just saying we should rely on. And Justice Barak's a great guy, but he's just doing what the rule of law lets you do. It lets you, if you're a good enough lawyer, and Justice Barak is a much better lawyer than John Yoo, it lets you produce a legal theory that ultimately authorizes you to do the thing that the state believes it needs to do when push comes to shove. The reason I'm saying this is just that, again, it's this sort of self-abnegation of a lawyer. Law is not enough. Law is not enough to protect us.
Well, I just wanted to, as someone who is not a lawyer, weigh in on this a little bit and say that I agree that maybe law is not enough in itself, but you have a situation in the Bush administration where you had reporters and others who publicized some episodes in which the law was pushed beyond reasonable points, where it was really turned into a joke, such as the definition of torture. And in addition, you had some lawyers within the administration, and it's one of the things that's impressed me all the way along in covering this area. You've had a number of lawyers who have a tremendous sense of conscience and responsibility, who, even though they may have shared the political views of the Bush administration, stood up and said, this is not a reasonable interpretation of the law. So I think in some ways it's not a story in which the rule of law was a failure. In fact, you have lawyers like Jim Comey, and you have lawyers, in some ways, Jack Goldsmith, despite what he wrote in that memo, turns out to be the one that says, when he takes a look at John Yoo's legal reasoning, that it's worthless and that they're going to have to rely on something else. And he's under tremendous pressure from the bureaucracy to stick with what he considers just a ridiculous legal theory. So there really are points beyond which
it's not as
you
optimistic.
Can't break it.
The real story isn't as optimistic as that. After Jack Goldsmith retracted as head of OLC the John Yoo memos, the next memo that the Office of Legal Counsel issued, just after Jack left, included a concluding sentence. It said, here's the good legal definition, and by the way, we've reviewed everything that we know of that the government has done, and they never did anything that violates the standard that we're now stating now. Right? So they wrote a new standard that would authorize everything that they thought had actually been done, including waterboarding, which we just saw in Judge Mukasey's outrageous, to my mind, confirmation hearings. So again, I mean, you can tell this great story about how great the rule of law is, and after it aired, it came back, but it's still not enough.
Well,
but
and
again, you know that because, I mean, we looked at that memo, and you've got lawyers, like in particular, the first person I know who noticed that famous footnote number 8 is a lawyer named Marty Lederman, who is a professor at Georgetown, and he said he could see, you know, he read it, he'd been at OLC himself, and he recognized it for the complete dodge that it was. And you know, the story is still unfolding. We don't really know whether it's going to come out on the right side of the rule of law or the wrong side, but I think it's wrong to conclude that the rule of law is meaningless, because I see this as a very vital and ongoing fight. I think there, you know, there are books like this, and there are articles every day, and there's the Bradbury memo that came out that the New York Times wrote about. And again, to go back to, maybe because I'm a political reporter, go back to this election, it seems to be more and more to be something that's up, going to be something that the public's going to deal with.
I would just add that I think that, you know, our argument is that the preventive paradigm, this notion that coercive measures of the state are permissible to be used against people and countries without objective evidence that they've done anything wrong, is what pushed the rule of law to the side, is what led to the compromises in the rule of law. And all the things that Noah talks about lawyers offering disingenuous and bad interpretations of the law, were done in violation of one of the most basic principles of the rule of law, which is transparency. And the administration has done everything it can to violate one of the other, or thrust aside one of the other basic principles of the rule of law, which is accountability. So first they adopt all of these views in secret, and only when they become public do they back off of them. And secondly, when anyone tries to hold them accountable for any of these legal violations, they argue that there's no, it's inappropriate, that the president can't be checked by the other branches when he's the commander-in-chief, or that we get to declare our own law violations to be secret, and then courts are not allowed to engage them. So I think this is it really is a sort of full-scale, full-frontal attack on the basic concept of the rule of law. And I think it's because one of the things the rule of law insists upon is that when the state employ its most coercive measures, like going to war or locking up a human being, it has to do so based on some record of wrongdoing and some fair process. And we threw that out because we weren't willing to establish that. And that's what got us into the war with Iraq. Whether you think it was justified in advance on the basis of, well, we're going to remake the Middle East, or whether you think it was justified on the ground that they might have weapons of mass destruction, in either event, it's a preventive war. And we asserted the right to go to war in a preventive context, which international law clearly and absolutely forbids, without getting the Security Council's authorization. And that's what's led us into the mess that we're in. So I think it's I think Justice Barak is absolutely right, and I'm not adopting everything that he said in that opinion. And in fact, we take a different view on the torture question, and we address that in the book, but the notion that the rule of law and accountability and transparency and judicial review and checks and balances and individual culpability, that these basic principles are on our side and are critical if we're going to be successful over the long term in keeping ourselves safe, I think that's what I take Justice Barak to be saying, and I think he's absolutely right, and I think the administration was absolutely wrong in thinking that those things are expendable.
I'll just say one other thing, then let's take some more questions. First of all, next questioner, come up to the mic. I was just going to say, in terms of the issue of whether or not it matters whether KSM is put on trial, I think that you win much more than just a conviction if you put KSM on trial, because it's not just about that particular case. It's about winning hearts and minds around the world. And what you do when you put somebody who's notorious like that on trial is you do have an advertisement for our legal system, and it can, I think it's a system that sells itself, basically. So if you're, what I think has been a real problem is to have a terrorist of the magnitude of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed able now to argue that he is the victim because he's been tortured? I mean, I think that's a political blunder of huge magnitude, and we really, really lost a major victory in the winning of hearts and minds if he can make himself into a sympathetic character somehow. Anyway, who's got a question? You want to come up to the microphone?
Thanks. Hi, David. Noah raised the question of what we should have done with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed when we caught him, and I definitely agree with your response, but I think the more difficult question is now that, as you correctly point out, the Bush administration has painted us in the corner by torturing him and obtaining evidence that would never be admissible in federal court, what do we do with him now? What do we do with him, the other 14 high-value, and other people held at Guantanamo that have been treated brutally for the past 5 years? I know, you know, there's now a Hoover Institution working group that's drafting preventive detention legislation, and I think that, you know, that is one very likely prospect, that this country will for the first time see preventive detention of suspected terrorists. But given the situation that we're in, what do you propose? Is there an alternative?
Yeah, well, I don't propose releasing him. I think that... but the question is a difficult one to answer, as is the question of what do we do in Iraq now, right? So the genie is out of the bottle. They've dug us into a hole that it's going to be very hard for whoever the next president is to dig us out of, even if they have every intention to do that. But I think that with respect to Guantanamo, I think as a pure matter of foreign policy, you have to close Guantanamo just because it's become, the two images, I think, best, most strongly associated around the world with the United States today are Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, you know, not the Statue of Liberty. And that's a terrible thing for us as we go forward. We talk about in our book an acquaintance of mine who was in Saudi Arabia in some remote place in a grocery store, and a young kid, a 12-year-old kid, comes running up to him to show him on his cell phone images of from Abu Ghraib. When young kids have cell phone images of Abu Ghraib on their, that they're carrying around, that is a disaster for us. So Guantanamo is a disaster along those lines. I think we have to close it. But then, I think you have to bring them here. But whether you bring them here or put them somewhere else, the key is we have to be willing to abide by the principles of the laws of war and fundamental fairness and due process. We have to give them fair hearings. And if we adjudicate in those fair hearings that they are, in fact, fighters for al-Qaeda, and there's no dispute that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example, is a fighter for al-Qaeda, we can continue to hold him, and we don't have to try him. I think it would be better, for the reasons Jane is saying, it would have been better if we had been able to have a number of trials at this point, because I think that would have changed the whole dynamic of how the world views Guantanamo. But the law of war doesn't require that you try people who are guilty of war crimes. It permits you to try people who are guilty of war crimes, but it also permits you to detain them for the duration of that particular conflict. And I think we have every right to do that if we were to provide fair hearings and if we were to commit to providing humane treatment of the individuals there. As to preventive detention of suspected terrorists, we don't really need it. We don't need that with respect to this question, because the law of war already allows you to engage in preventive detention of those who are fighting against you. That's not a new concept. That's not inconsistent with the rule of law. The law of war has recognized that authority for a very, very long time. And there's just two principles. You've got to give them a hearing that's fair, and you've got to treat them humanely. And again, had we done that, I don't think that Guantanamo would be the disaster it is today.
Can I just ask David a question that follows on that?
Sure.
I assume, this is my own view, and maybe you don't agree with it. I assume that if Guantanamo worked somehow, which it doesn't, or if Abu Ghraib had never become public, right, I assume that those things would be wrong because they are morally wrong. That's not why I think, I happen to think that they're also harmful to us, but I never want to make that the key point of my argument with respect to those things. I mean, they're just plain wrong, and I think it's important to keep that in my view, at least, front and center.
Absolutely. And the first part of our book is they're just plain wrong. But my sense, you know, in arguing these issues for the last 20 years, is that it's not enough for the American public to say they're wrong. It's important to say they're wrong, but it's also important to demonstrate that they're stupid, to demonstrate that they're ineffectual, to demonstrate that they're counterproductive. And I think this is true with respect to almost any sort of systemic problem. That's certainly the case in the criminal justice system. You know, there's lots that's morally objectionable about the kind of double standards that we've employed in the criminal justice system. But it's I think that's an important argument that needs to be made. But if you don't also demonstrate that they're counterproductive, if you don't also demonstrate that they're hurting us, then I think you're not going to be as persuasive as you could be. And I think that precisely for the reasons that Justice Barak articulates in that quote, there's a real connection between the immoral and the ineffectual. That is, the reason that they are counterproductive most often goes back to the fact that they're immoral and the fact that they violate the rule of law. That's why we can't use the evidence in a court of law. That's why the world has turned against us. That's why in Great Britain they think the most dangerous person in the world is Osama bin Laden, but the second most dangerous person is George Bush. Right? So in fact, you know, there's often trade-offs to be made, and we don't dispute that. But in this context, and with this particular paradigm, we have sacrificed our moral principles, and we've gotten nothing for it except put ourselves in a worse position.
If there are other questions, I'm going to take a couple at a time, if you could, for these guys. Just come on up and first one and then the next, so that so we don't run out of time here.
This question's for Noah. I'd like to invite you to reconsider your argument about Iraq and the idea that order needed to be established first and then the rule of law later. I think the sequencing is a very dangerous idea. And I wonder if, I mean, we went into Iraq and there was order already when we went in. We went in to establish a different kind of order. And the thing that distinguished us, presumably, was that it was going to be an order that had a rule of law. And the point I'm making is I think the way we get to this place we're going requires that we use certain methods or else we're not going to get there. As a South African, I'd make the argument by reference to my own experience in South Africa, which is in South Africa you had a resistance against the apartheid regime, and then you had a negotiation, and then you had a truth and reconciliation process. Now, some people think that the order came through the negotiation and then the rule of law and the reconciliation happened after the Truth Commission. But in fact, South Africa was able to reconcile as a society because of the way that the ANC fought its liberation struggle. When the negotiation started, no white South Africans could think that the ANC thought of them as the enemy. The ANC had fought a very principled liberation struggle where the apartheid state was the enemy. And they always made a very careful justification of their use of violence, which is why it strikes all of us as being just not true when people speak of the ANC as a terrorist organization, because they'd used a particular way of trying to advance their ends. So I think the pursuit of the rule of law and order at the same time is intertwined in a way that I don't think your sequencing recognizes and therefore is dangerous.
Okay. We'll take one more question here.
Yeah, David, I'm surprised that you insist that the idea that our holding the people who are in Guantanamo is relatively uncontroversial under the law of war scenario, because I think there's a lot of people in the world who think that the armed conflict in Afghanistan ended several years ago, and there's a lot of people in Guantanamo who never were near Afghanistan, and that your second statement somewhat later that the law of war provides, you didn't use the word, but a magic bullet to solve the problem of what do we do with these people, give them a hearing and then give them a trial if that's appropriate, I think it doesn't really work, because I think the answer would have been that many of these people should have been returned, and maybe that is the right answer. But I don't think the law of war actually justifies some of the things that you're saying it would justify, and I think it's much more controversial whether or not it applies.
And one more question. This is it, then.
short question that might be a complicated answer. My first is for Noah. You may remember I moderated a panel in which you were speaking in San Francisco 2 years ago, and at that time you were asked, let's not look backwards, looking forward in Iraq, what do you recommend we do now? And you actually had some good ideas. I wonder if you have good ideas now.
Did you see how well those went?
For David, I have a question looking backwards. I've talked with several people who lived through the 50s, who were on blacklists, who were questioned by HUAC, who lost their livelihoods, who had to flee the country. And they say that now this time scares them more than that time. You talk about less free, less safe. I just wonder, is that miss? You know, do you agree with that? Are we that much less free and safe? Can you put things in perspective?
Okay, on the question about whether the law of war non-controversially allows us to hold people fighting for al-Qaeda against us. I that's a good point, and I think that there is some debate, there's certainly debate about the extent to which one can extend it beyond the conflict, the traditional conflict with Afghanistan and with the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. I think it is an extension of the principles of the laws of war just to pick up people all over the world and claim that because they're with al-Qaeda we can hold them for the duration of the conflict. But I think that's actually a reasonable extension, and that if that were the only extension that we were arguing for, it would look very different than if we were arguing that we don't have to tell you who they are, we don't have to give them any hearings, there's no law that applies, they have no rights, the Geneva Conventions don't apply, and we'll only treat them humanely because the president has decided that we'll treat them humanely and we'll define humanely to include injecting people with IV fluids until they urinate on themselves. You know, I think that's where the real nub of the problem lies. On the question of comparing this period to the Cold War, my first post 9/11 book, Enemy Aliens, has quite a bit of historical perspective because, of course, it was written shortly after 9/11, and I wanted to look at the prior periods. And one of the things that struck me in doing the research for that book, which looked at all the periods of crisis that we've had in the United States, is that people almost always say that the time they're in is the worst. It particularly struck me because I read a book called The History of Repression in America or something, and it was some PhD dissertation written during the Vietnam War, and it had some incredible stories of very detailed stories of the kinds of abuses that happened in the Alien and Sedition Acts and during World War I, where we threw over 2,000 people in jail for merely uttering words against the war, the McCarthy era, where over 1 million people were subject to these loyalty review boards and the like, and the book concludes that, but this is the time. This is really the worst possible time. So I think I'm always sort of skeptical of that claim, and I think that I'm one of the things that gives me sort of hope about the current time is the historical comparison. And I think, if you think back to the McCarthy era and you think about sort of who was standing up to what was going on, there were very few organizations that were standing up to what was going on. The ACLU, what was it doing? It was purging itself of communists. Right? It wasn't defending the communists. You had the National Lawyers Guild, you had the National Emergency Civil Liberties Committee. They defended the communists. They got red-baited as communists for daring to defend the communists. By contrast, today, you have an incredibly strong civil society sector. It includes the ACLU that I think has been doing a tremendous job, but it includes a whole host of organizations that didn't even exist 50 years ago, the immigrants' rights groups, the religious organizations, the civil rights groups, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the human rights groups, right? The whole human rights revolution happened in the interim. The internet and privacy groups, they clearly didn't exist back then because Al Gore hadn't yet invented the internet. And those groups, I think, have played a tremendous role in checking what has gone on, and in standing up for these principles of the rule of law, of accountability, of transparency, and the like. And I actually attribute what we have gained, and I'm a little more optimistic than Anne about this, in terms of forcing them to retreat on torture, retreat on cruel and human and degrading treatment, retreat on the notion that Guantanamo is a lawless place, law-free place, retreat on the notion that they have to provide no hearings, retreat on the notion that they can hold enemy combatants, even citizens, without any hearings whatsoever, retreat on the NSA program and say we've terminated and now put it through the through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the very statute they said they couldn't possibly abide by before Anne's case declared it was illegal to ignore it. I think those are significant victories, and I attribute them to this civil society sector standing up, organizing, doing sophisticated education outreach, filing lawsuits, getting international opinion behind these principles, and standing up for what this country stands for. At its best. And I think that's given backbone to the press, which I think has been quite good, at least significant parts of the press, particularly Jane, of course, but in bringing to light some of these the worst abuses, and to the courts, which more than any other time in our history have been willing to stand up to administration claims of executive power in times of national security. So I don't think this is the worst possible time, and I think there's been significant checks, and I think we have to keep fighting, and the fight is not over, and I have no illusion that if a Democrat wins, these issues are going to go away, but I think we should recognize the importance role that the civil society sector has played.
Now, Noah, you want to fix Iraq for us?
Well, on the question of sequencing, I used to think, I think I would have agreed exactly with that formulation before I went to Iraq. Now I think something a little different. Not quite as different as it sounds like the view you're attributing to me, but it's something a little different. I think, to be very precise about it, that the rule of law and rule of law values, it's not that they're meaningless, it's that they cannot function in a meaningful way without a structure of order behind them. That structure of order is known as the state. And my own interpretation of the way that the transition in South Africa was able to function effectively is that the ANC, though they fought a war against the apartheid state, never sought to destroy the institutions of the state itself. They sought to destroy the unjust institution on which the state was built, namely apartheid. So that when the transition happened, the transition happened through a transfer of control over the reins of the state, but the state remained intact. Now, so again, it's not that the rule of law isn't important. The rule of law is hugely important. Without it, you can't legitimate the state in a morally justifiable way. That's the only way we humans know how to do it. But it's that it alone, the rule of law alone, won't get you there. And what I learned in Iraq is that when you're doing rule of law stuff alongside the creation of the state stuff, smart people and dumb people, doesn't really matter, but almost everybody thinks that the rule of law stuff that you're doing means they don't have to worry so much about the state. That's what happened in the administration, and it wasn't just the administration, it was also outside the administration. Many, many people believed that because we were making progress on things that look like the rule of law, that therefore we didn't have to worry quite as much about the formation of this powerful entity, the state. And because we who live in a powerful state spend our time appropriately worrying about making that state conform to the rule of law, which is what we should be doing, that's what all the civil society institutions you just described are doing, when we're faced with a situation where the state itself needs to be shored up, I won't say we're without resources, but we're very weak with respect to the kinds of arguments that we know how to make. That would not have been true a couple of hundred years ago. It was not true of the founding fathers of the United States, for example, who were obsessed with law, but first thought that you had to create a state, and then subsequently could worry about law within it. So the secret, I don't disagree with you that the two are intermingled, and I'm not saying create an unjust state and then hope that justice will emerge in it. That's not a very good prescription either. But it's that we tend to overvalue the state, and overvalue the law, rather. And from the other perspective, and this is the point that I was making earlier, again, it's not that the rule of law is valueless. It's that the rule of law is not enough. Rule of law is not enough to create a state on the one hand, and the rule of law is not enough to stop the state from doing immoral things on the other hand. What you need is morality. For that, you actually need morality. You need people in the relevant seats who will not do exactly what the administration did, which is turn to a group of lawyers and say, is it legal? right? I mean, in Henry V, there's this great moment before Henry goes to war where he talks to the Archbishop of Canterbury to give him some justification to go to war, and he's seeking a legal justification. And his punchline after this long and involved legal opinion, OLC opinion, he says, "May I, with right and justice, make this claim?" And the answer from the Archbishop of Canterbury is, "The sin upon my head, dread sovereign." You know, so go ahead and do it. And then he goes off and, you know, violates every known law of war, right? And the play tells you that, and the actual guy did that too. You're always going to have an executive who's going to ask the question, is it lawful? And if that's the point where someone needs to stand up and not just say, well, it's not lawful. That won't be enough. Someone has to say it's immoral as well. And I don't think this is not to disagree with anything that David says. I don't think he disagrees with me about this. It's just to say that we need to keep our eye on that. Now, with respect to Iraq, the good ideas of a couple of years ago were already wrapped in the unlikelihood of their being effectuated, but the main one, they were all driven by this idea that the need was to create a situation of order in which the political process could actually mean something. We tried that in the form of the surge, but it was not sufficient at any real juncture to eliminate the fighting. There were people before who said that very clearly, some because they thought that no amount of troops would make a difference, some people thought because they thought that another 30,000 troops wouldn't make a difference. Doesn't matter, they were all right. And now we're in a situation where we fail to create order. So the question now is, what, if anything, can outsiders do in Iraq that will move the country towards order? And I don't mean the order of a single dominant state, because that's not even viable in Iraq now. So that's how far things have fallen. Now we first have to see the emergence of just some cobbled-together balance of power where people aren't shooting each other every day. And, you know, that's going to be the challenge for whoever is the next president. And I think a Democrat or Republican will handle it more or less the same way. We're going to withdraw a certain number of troops and kind of see how many people kill each other as a result. We're already starting that experimentation now. You know, we take X number of troops out of this place, and then we just wait and see whether everyone starts killing each other. And through that process, what you'll get are sort of on-the-ground power-sharing arrangements, and that's probably the best we can do right now. But it's not good, and it's not good enough.
One more question.
We haven't talked much about part three of your book, David, and I just wanted to maybe have you tick off a few of the alternative preventive suggestions in that part of your book and have Noah respond. I'd be very curious to hear what Noah's views are on some of those proposals.
Thank you. I think the first point is that we're not against prevention as a goal. Right? We all want to prevent the next terrorist attack from occurring. So it's not the concept of prevention that we're critiquing. We're critiquing this use of harsh, coercive measures preventively on the basis of speculation about the future. So, you know, we brush our teeth. We believe in prevention. What we don't believe in is random root canals. And that's what we've seen from the administration. So what we offer is a whole host of preventives, you know, I think non-controversial preventive measures that would actually make us safer without causing the kind of blowback effects and the negative consequences that the administration's preventive paradigm has had. And most of these are not particularly novel. And in fact, I mean, we adopt most of what the 9/11 Commission proposed, which was 42 recommendations about how we can keep ourselves safer. Things like protecting nuclear stockpiles in the former Soviet Union so terrorists can't get a hold of them, a better screening of cargo on planes. We screen passengers but not cargo for the most part, a better screening of containers coming into shipping ports, reaching out to the moderate Muslim world and seeking their support instead of treating the Muslim world as suspect until proven innocent in some way, which only alienates them. Exercising our power throughout the world through foreign aid and public diplomacy rather than through military might. One of the things that people who look at what sort of inspires terrorists to take action is this, you know, the sort of sense of military occupation and military presence. And we have our military budget is larger than the next 10 countries combined, far larger than it certainly needs to be, and yet we have the lowest per capita foreign aid of any developed nation. One of the few countries in the world where anti-Americanism actually fell in a significant way in the post 9/11 period is Indonesia, a significantly Muslim country. And why was that? Because after the tsunami, we sent former President Clinton and former President Bush over there to actually help people. And they saw the United States as helping and using its power and its resources to aid people in need rather than to impose its will through military might and strong arming. So that's certainly important. I think dealing with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in a way that doesn't just side with one country and tries to actually seek resolution of that conflict would be tremendously important. And then we also are not against the use of coercion, coercion pursuant to the rule of law rather than coercion that throws the rule of law out by the wayside. And so Guantanamo, which I've talked about quite a bit, is an example. We think if we had followed, that's coercive to lock people up preventively, but I think if we had followed the basic principles of the rule of law there, again, we would not be in the disastrous mess that we are there. And just the last thing I would say is the 9/11 Commission, after putting out these recommendations, and it was a bipartisan commission, not out to attack the administration. They did a report card about a year and a half ago on how the administration was doing on these, and it's like no report card that you'd ever want to see any of your children come home with. It's something like 5 Fs, 8 Ds, 11 Cs, 1 A minus. So while the administration has been acting tough, talking tough, rendering suspects to be tortured, torturing them themselves, locking people up without any kinds of hearings and trials, going to war against a country which didn't attack us or threaten us, we have been failing to do these much more sensible measures that actually might make us safer without playing into al-Qaeda's hands by increasing anti-American sentiment around the world.
All right, I was just going to add one other of the solutions that I, if I remember this correctly, that you suggested was also that the U.S. maybe should close some of its military bases around the world. So I wanted to add that to the list of things that Noah might respond to.
The overwhelming majority of the things that David proposes are, you know, as you say, they're reasonable bipartisan things that any right-thinking person would say absolutely right on. And while obviously not just the 9/11 Commission but the American people believe that the administration is getting a failing grade, you know, what's the president's approval rating right now? Right, it's in the 20s, so that's definitely not passing. I mean, it's less than half of the people even who voted for him in the first place, right? Nevertheless, I want to say that the interesting question to me is how will the next president, assuming even that it's a Democrat, look on this same set of criteria when they are proposed if the 9/11 Commission comes back and checks in on it 2 years into that presidency? I would predict that the next president will also score very badly. There might be an ex-president who could do some of the publicly attractive-looking features of these descriptions, but all of the ones that require difficult engagement with either a global power structure which has been created before this administration and in which we're enmeshed, and that's the example of the military bases, or B, that require the acquiescence of people whom we do not control. So I would take the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and put it there. I would take Iraq and put it there. Those will all be things where I would predict, descriptively, that the next president will also do very badly in all these respects. And the reason is that, and this is always a problem, especially in foreign policy, you're just never writing on a blank slate. You're inheriting a world that's shaped by policies, bad as they may have been, and then you're trying to operate within the constraints, the very enormous constraints those propose. So, for example, when it comes to removing military bases, let me just take a great example. Take South Korea, right? I mean, South Korea, we've got, still have about 40,000 troops there. Costs a lot of money to us. The South Koreans don't even like the fact that we have troops there. If you take a poll in South Korea, you get an overwhelming desire of people to remove them. Any rational person would say this is a no-brainer, right? So why are our troops still there, and why will they still be there after President Obama or President Clinton II, right? I mean, the answer is going to turn out to be that we're enmeshed in a complicated situation in the area, and actually removal of the troops might increase the likelihood of regional war. And it turns out that lots of people, including people in the power structure of South Korea, are going to turn out to want it. And I'm just using this as a simple example of how the constraints are profound in this particular arena. By contrast, and here I'll say something for the rule of law, just so that nobody leaves me, I've got nothing good to say about it. When it comes to the rule of law, it's pretty easy to repair things, right? And then you tell a story about how we made a mistake before and we're going to fix it, and now we're going to follow the rule of law. And that's a kind of heroic story, and it's one of the reasons that the rule of law is so attractive, because it feels like an area where you can make real progress, where you can point to good court decisions alongside the bad ones, where you can point to good language in a court decision alongside the bad language. And last but not least, it's an area where a small group of people who care a lot about it can really do an enormous amount. And that's a fantastic and moving and significant feature of the rule of law, and it's enormously to David's credit that he is so much at the vanguard of that movement. So I continue to admire what he's doing, and I admire the book he's written.
Well, great. Listen, thank you, both of you, for an incredible discussion. I really think it's been amazing. So, thank you.